So Samson, is he a hero? Is he a warrior? A womanizer, definitely. A destroyer? Is it the glory of Israel or the shame of Israel? He's a man who rightly saw the Philistine men as the enemy. He was also a man who slept with and gave his heart recklessly away to Philistine women. People who read Judges are often left with a big question mark over his life. Should we respect him, or should we disown him as a terrible example? He's a very violent and immoral Old Testament character, after all. And some Christians would rather kind of push the Old Testament and people like Samson a bit to the side. I read in the Times magazine yesterday, Samantha Cameron, she described herself as a New Testament Christian. So I kind of think must mean that she sort of looks at this kind of passage and think, well, that bit's not for me, but the New Testament I like. Well, actually, Samson wasn't written just as a warning of how not to act. For the original readers, or the Israelites, he was a mirror, not for how they shouldn't be, but for how they actually were acting. This was no warning for the future. This was a mirror back to them. This is what you are now. This is how you're acting now. Don't look down on Samson. You are Samson. So in chapter 16, Samson's final acts are drawing to a climax that will leave him stood between two massive pillars. But before we get there, he's doing what he loves to do. He's loving Philistine women, and he's fighting and humiliating the Philistine men. However, in this chapter, there's no mention of the Spirit of the Lord coming upon him in power, as we saw in previous chapters. It would appear that Samson's strength has gone to his head. No longer is the victory the Lord's through the Spirit's power, but the victory is Samson's through Samson's power. And it comes across, I couldn't help thinking I was reading this week, it comes across like a game for Samson. It's the one-man show. It's the Samson show. It's Samson versus the Philistines. And you can't help but feel that Samson just loves it. Now, the risks are high for Samson, as we see with the story with Delilah. But Samson's like a desperate gambler in a casino. He's destined to lose every penny he owns. And yet the thought of walking away from the danger and leaving the gambling table never enters his head. Samson simply won't leave the Philistines alone. And if one day this story is made into a film, perhaps has been already, I don't know of it. If it's made into a film, then part of the backing track that we won't be able to forget will be Samson's laugh. We'd all know the sound, if we watch the film, when it comes out, we'd all know the sound of Samson's laugh. Because as you read this passage, you can almost hear him chuckling away as he goes from one episode to the next. And that would be the background noise of the film. Until that is, things finally take a kind of less positive turn for Samson. So, the points on the sheet. Can't leave them alone, number one. Love's going to get you, I'll explain that later, number two. And thirdly, do we really trust in God's strength? These 3 points I'm going to talk about coming from Samson, but they're also their mirrors for the Israelites, who would have been the first listeners and readers of this. This is you, Israelites. This isn't just Samson. So, firstly, can't leave them alone. Once Samson becomes an adult, it's clear where he takes his adventures, in Philistine territory. This clearly, for Samson, is where the action is. And Samson loves the action. So chapter 14 begins, Samson went down to Timnah, and he saw there a young Philistine woman. Chapter 16, our chapter, one day Samson went to Gaza, that's the Philistine capital, where he saw a prostitute. And in 16 verse 4, different woman to 16 verse 1, sometime later he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek. It's in between when the Philistines and the Israelites camped. Samson's action remind me of the song, "Be careful." Is it "Be careful, little feet, where you go? Be careful, little eyes, what you look at." That song, about where you look, where you go, what you see, what your heart goes out to, what you let yourself love, and it caused Samson all kinds of problems. Now, Samson isn't one to stay at home and listen to the good old stories about the history of Israel. No, Samson's out to make his own stories. He wants to create a history that will never be forgotten. And wherever Samson goes, drama follows. He's like somebody who thinks, forget staying in, having a quiet night in with a nice film, or seeing what's on television, or reading a book. I'm off out to make my own action. Samson doesn't do quiet nights in with his own people. For Samson, the Philistines is where the fun is. And that's where Samson's going to be. So back, just to go back a chapter, we can see that God is clearly at work in and using Samson. We're told three times in 14 verse 6, 14 19, 15 verse 14, these words. So three times, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon him. And almost all the time that's mentioned, it's about Samson subduing the Philistines, which was a fulfillment of the promise from the angel. He will begin to save Israel from its enemies. But in our chapter, chapter 16, certainly for the first part, there's no mention of the Spirit. It seems that Samson's lost his way. And this phrase, "the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon him," isn't repeated. If we rewind to the start of chapter 14, we'll see the roots of why Israel has lost its way. Now Samson's gone to Timnah, he's seen a Philistine woman, he wants to marry her. His parents, though, realise this isn't a good idea. His dad Manoah and his mum plead with Samson. These are their words in chapter 14. "Isn't there an acceptable woman amongst your relatives, amongst our people? Must he go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife?" Samson ignores them. He's already ignored God's instructions in the law, Deuteronomy 7, about intermarrying with foreign women. And now he defies the fifth commandment. He ignores his parents. "Get her for me. She's the right one for me." And interestingly, the ESV puts it, "She's right in my eyes." And if you've been following Judges closely, you'll see that's a common refrain in the book. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So when Samson's saying that, he's just saying what the people are saying and acting and living out. It wasn't just Samson's issues. People couldn't tut-tut and point at Samson and say, "Look at Samson." This was the whole of Israel in Judges as they drift further and further away from God and his laws. They're not doing what's right in God's eyes. Everyone's doing what they see fit in their eyes. As somebody put it on Wednesday night, I wasn't there, but this is quoted to me, Israel must have been in a pretty bad way if Samson was considered the best man to lead them. I don't know whose quote that was, but it was helpful. So Samson was a mirror to and of his people. And if any of them were thinking, "Oh, Samson," they'd have got a shock when the fingers pointed back at them. No, this is you. This is what you do. This is who you are. And it reminds me, you know the story of Nathan when he goes to David to explain his adultery to Bathsheba and how awful it is? And instead of saying, "David, what you've done is wrong," he gives that story of the man with the sheep. And David says, "That man's terrible, that man's terrible." And Nathan goes, "It's you." And that's the kind of idea we get here with Samson. So chapter 16, Samson continues with his motto, his mantra, doing right in his own eyes. He's off into the heart of Philistine territory again. He's looking for fun. This is the beginning of chapter 16. 16, verse 1. And what does he see with his eyes? A prostitute. Samson's pleasure in humiliating the Philistines is not about to stop. He's laughing at them. It's as though he's saying to the Philistines, "Hey, Philistines, I can have your women and I can kill your men. What are you going to do about it?" Complete humiliation of both the women and the men. And I was thinking, that's kind of sometimes what you hear about in the newspaper, isn't it? You hear about stories of people who fall out. And that's what they do. Or gangs. They want to sleep with the women and they want to destroy the men. So it's no different in some ways. Well, the Philistines actually are going to do something about it, though. That comes later on in the chapter. Before that, we have this story in Gaza. Samson probably is aware of the plot for them waiting until dawn to kill him. But Samson's got plans of his own. If you look in 16 verse 3, this is what Samson does. Samson lay there only until the middle of the night. Then he got up and took hold of the doors of the city gate together with the two posts and tore them loose, bar and all. He lifted them to his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Now note, there's no mention of the Spirit of the Lord. It wasn't the Spirit of the Lord who came upon him powerfully and he ripped up the gateposts. This is just fun for Samson. It's another way of laughing at the Philistines. You gotta go by yourself. Okay. It's just fun for Samson. It's another way of laughing at the Philistines. As I said, he just can't leave them alone. He can't get enough of them. Second point. Love's going to get you. So this is focusing on his relationship with Delilah. Now there was a song. Came out about 30 years ago. And these are the lines of the song. It's very unlikely you'll know it, don't worry. Love. That word love is a very serious thing. And if you don't watch out, love's going to get you. And this song could have been written for Samson. Here's a man who doesn't just like what he sees in the Philistine women and then leaves. Bye-bye. He lets his heart go completely out to them. So we're told he fell in love with the woman from the Valley of Sorek, Delilah. As I said with the geography, the Valley of Sorek lay between the territory of the Israelites and the Philistines. But it's almost certain that Delilah, whose name sounds in Hebrew like the night, was a Philistine. And what's interesting is you've got the parallels between the story of Delilah and Samson's wife from Timri back in chapter 14. And you'll see these two parallel stories and got some really striking similarities. Straight away, in verse 5, the Philistine rulers get to hear that Samson's with Delilah. Kind of get the idea that maybe Delilah and the rulers are in pact here, unison, maybe before even Samson came. Sounds like a setup. Having been humbled by Samson in Gaza, they want to turn the tables. You can picture some of them having had to look up to Samson when he took the city gates up to the top of the hill as he laughed down at them. They're keen to put this right. So look, verse 5, immediately the rulers went to Delilah and they said, let's look at verse 5, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so we may tie him up and subdue him. Each one of us will give you 1,100 shekels of silver." That's 1,100 each. And we think there were five rulers. So 5,500. This is big money. Later on in Judges, we find out that 10 shekels is about a day's wages. So this is lottery winning money. It's massive. And Delilah's keen. There's no sense here that she kind of, oh, I don't know, should I, shouldn't I? And the speed between verses 4 and 5 suggests this was planned for some time. It was like the Philistines thought, we know his weakness. We've seen it before, he's not going to change, we're going to be ready for him. And perhaps they've been storing that money up for some time. Well, back in chapter 14, Samson's wife She's also paid a visit from some Philistine men. Samson set them the riddle, and they go to the woman there and say, "Tell us what the riddle means. Get Samson to tell you." It was the riddle about the lion and the honey. But on that occasion, they didn't say, "We'll give you 5,500 shekels." They say, "If you don't, we'll burn you and your father." And these were not idle threats. Both women, for two very different reasons, want Samson to tell them the secret. The secret to the riddle, and the other, the secret of his strength. Now, Samson acts tough in both cases. "I'm not telling you." He laughs at them. It's all a game, a joke for Samson. But what breaks his resistance, and he caves in, is the same on both occasions. It's an accusation against him. So his wife, the Timnite woman, in chapter 14 says, well, she threw herself against him and sobbed, "You hate me. You don't really love me." And she cried for days. Contrast this with Delilah. Now she's been complaining about him making a fool of her. "You've made a fool of me. You've mocked me." And with Samson telling all the different possible ways to break his strength. So, you know, breaks the bowstring, the new ropes, unpins his hair. And then, "The Philistines are here," cries Delilah. The thing is, with the third lie, with the unpinning of the hair, it seems a bit close to the truth, doesn't it? It seems like his resistance is weakening. Little by little, he's weakening as he stays with the enemy, Delilah. And here's a warning to us. If we're in a dangerous situation, or a situation like this, get out quickly. Don't linger with sin and temptation. Don't hang around to see what will happen. The truth is, Samson was blind to what was happening. He was blind to what was happening even before his eyes were actually removed. And David Jackman says, "We can see Samson slipping by stages to his doom, apparently unaware of what is happening." Delilah's fully aware, though. This isn't a joke for her. She wants her money. And so this is what Delilah says. So the Timnite woman has said, "You hate me, you don't really love me." And Delilah says, "How can you say I love you when you won't confide in me, or your heart's not with mine?" Another translation. And we're told that Delilah nags him until he's sick to death of it. So for both women, it was the accusation, "You don't really love me," that broke his resolve. He gives in, and he tells them everything, both occasions. Perhaps when Samson started this, it was all some kind of sport or a game to show his power. But somewhere along the line, his heart is tugged and gradually pulled away. So the song lyrics I said earlier, love is a serious thing. And if you don't watch out, love is going to get you, are true. Samson's treated it as a joke, a game to play while laughing at the Philistines. But love is a serious thing, it's right. It's not something to be trifled with. And Samson had lost his heart to a foreign people, and it was his undoing. However, like I've been explaining, this isn't just about foolish Samson. Samson mirrors the people. They've been tolerating intermarriage with the Canaanites for years, as they were expressly told not to do so in Deuteronomy, in the law. They'd ensnared themselves and opened up themselves to the lure of foreign gods every time. And God had promised, if you intermarry, the foreign wives and husbands will turn your hearts away from me to serve other gods. Samson's just a picture of what Israel is doing. His running after foreign women is what Israel had been doing for decades. Idolatry, loving other things more than God, is rife, where Baal worship and Asherah pole devotion runs through the whole book of Judges. And whenever there's intermarriage and joining with those who don't love the Lord, it always leads to idolatry and watered down and a weak devotion to God. And it made me think about the lukewarm believers in Revelation and what God does to them. "I'll spit you out of my mouth." So the application here to us hopefully is obvious. Or our hearts and allegiances being tugged by those who don't care for our souls before God? Do we or have we allowed casual romances to start up with non-believers thinking, there's nothing serious to it? Such thinking is dangerous. All our close friendships need to be weighted with the thought, will this friendship strengthen my faith and devotion to the Lord or compromise and destroy it? It wasn't that foreigners in Israel couldn't come to faith. We have the story of Rahab, for example. But to seek out marriage with men and women who are happily serving other gods will always lead to idolatry. And that applies to us as much as to Israel. Thirdly, do we really trust in God's strength? Do we really trust in God's strength? Now, I mentioned it when I spoke earlier with the space shuttle. I talked about the story from his mum and dad about the angel's promise. And I wonder for Samson whether it was just a story from when he was a young boy. The Nazarite vow, the separating himself apart for God. What did he think of the story of the angel ascending into the flame after it spoke to his mum and dad back in chapter 13? Did he take it seriously? Obviously, Samson knew his own strength. But what did he think about the promise of the wine and the hair? Maybe he laughed at that too. Maybe he wasn't really sure. Maybe, for Samson, he just had his parents' word for it. And when he gives in and tells Delilah everything, it does feel a bit like he's just repeating the story he was told many years ago. In telling the story, Samson, he's got no respect for himself. He's treating the Lord's words with no reverence, no holiness. He's not fearing God. He's not loving his family. He's not honouring his parents. And love has clouded his thinking. What's worse too is Delilah clearly doesn't love him. There's no mention anywhere here that she loves him. All we're told is that she wants the money. If you look at verse 19. We're told after his hair has been cut, his strength left him. And then if you look at verse 20. You've also got someone leaving him. The Lord left him. And the writer's not doing this by accident. So his strength left him. The Lord left him. The writer wants to make this painfully clear. The Lord is his strength. And that's what the people of Israel, and that's what we need to grasp hold of. You see, the moment his strength left him, the Lord left him. Or you could put it the other way. The moment the Lord left him, his strength left him. And I thought this is a bit, you know, in the Psalms when it says, is it the phrase Selah? And no one's really sure what it means, but some people say, well, maybe it means pause and think about it. And I thought this is a Selah moment. The moment his strength left him, the Lord left him. And I'm sure that's what the writer was trying to make clear to all the readers. The Lord is your strength. Don't forget it. Samson's strength was and is never to be viewed as a natural attribute outside of the supernatural power of the Lord. His parents' words to him, though told many years previously, were the truth. And perhaps it was his disdain and lack of respect for his parents, as we saw in chapter 14, that made him forget. But it really seems as though he thought that without his hair, he'd go out just as before. So it says he awoke from his sleep and he thought, I'll go out as before and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had left him. Samson's problem was he divorced power and strength from the Lord God. He may not have voiced it, but really power and strength for Samson came in himself. He thought he could go it alone. Success and power had bred arrogance and conceit. And he didn't even realize the Lord had left him. So it's a warning for the Israelites. Were they going out in their own strength? And we see this all over the Old Testament. Whenever they did that, failure. And it's a warning for us. Has success affected how we see God? Has success meant we think strength and power is ours? And Samson didn't even realize the Lord had left him. It's scary. He didn't have no sense. He didn't realize that his strength was all of God's grace and none of his effort. And in telling Delilah, who was the knight in Hebrew, he was in fact laughing in the face of the angel of the Lord. So back in chapter 13, the angel told his mother, "You'll become pregnant and have a son whose head is never to be touched by a razor, because the boy is to be a Nazarite dedicated to God from the womb." These were holy words, a holy promise. And Samson treated them like he could just chuck them away. So Samson tells the knight, an evil force, of the riches of the angel's words and the promise. Here's a betrayal of the truth. It's like passing secret war information into the hands of the enemy forces. Here's a serious and holy promise from the angel that was binding. And Samson treats it like an old story, a fairy tale to throw about and share. So it's a danger for us. Do we ever treat God's holy words like fairy tales? And if we treat God's words as a joke, we'll be the ones that suffer. As I said, there's no moment in this chapter where Delilah's ever on Samson's side. She didn't love him. She wants him dead while she has the riches. And there must be few more wicked women in the Bible than Delilah of the Philistines. So as Samson scorns and laughs at God's words and laughs at the angel's promise, telling them to Delilah, his fate's sealed. We mock God at our own risk. We're told in the New Testament, God will not be mocked. So, the man who told his parents in chapter 14, "Get her for me, she's right in my eyes," has his own eyes removed. Here's a warning for Israel if there ever was one. Don't ever think you can go alone in your own strength. Never think success is due to what you've done or achieved. Your strength is in the Lord. His grace is your power. Don't be fooled. So as I've been saying again and again, this isn't just a story about a man who messed up. This is a mirror for the people of Israel. So I'm going to go back over my points just quickly. Can't leave them alone. This could be you, Israel. You can't leave the nations alone either. You're always whoring after their gods, thinking you can share them with me and still have me. Number two, love's going to get you. You love these other gods as well. Your idolatry for foreign gods will destroy you. Your life's at risk, Israel. And thirdly, do you trust in God's strength? No, you don't, Israel. If you did, you'd never desert me. You'd never share me. Your success has bred conceit. There's no humility in you. And from Israel, it's probably wise for us to feel the weight of these points on our own lives. Samson is meant not primarily as a warning for what could happen, but as a reflection of what is happening. So are there things in our lives now that we can't leave alone? Sins we can't shrug off? Friendships that we should sever but don't? Places we find ourselves returning to? Is the love of things on earth eating us up? Out to get us? Consuming our time, our thoughts and our money? Do we really see God as all-powerful, trusting in him alone? Well, the gouging out of the eyes has to be the ultimate warning for Israel. I will remove you if you continue to live as you see fit, if you continue doing what is right in your own eyes. And as we think of the book of Judges, we think forward to the exile, because God will remove them. So, back in Judges 16, in a moment of poetic justice, the Philistines take Samson back to the scene of their humiliation at his hands. Where? Gaza, of course. Back in 16 verse 5, they told Delilah, "We want to humble Samson." And here's the humbling. Where once Samson had taken the gates up a hill, laughing, chuckling, now they take him bald and blinded back to Gaza. No doubt laughing at him as they leave him in jail, grinding grain. Then verse 22, we're told a little glimmer of hope. His hair had begun to grow again. So, that was part one. Weakness and apparent strength. And part two. Strength and apparent weakness. It's going to be the end of the party. Now, behind all the action going on, God's honour is at stake. And somebody said that we can get so caught up with the great story and the action and the characters that actually we kind of lose sight. This is about God's honour. This is about other gods, false gods, claiming that they're to be honoured. And actually, God's honour is at stake here. And we should care when God's honour is at stake. We should care when God's name is dishonoured. It should bother us. When the latter part of chapter 16, the glory due to God is going elsewhere. It's going to a fake god called Dagon. And there's a massive party for it, in which Samson, who represents both God and Israel, is brought out to laugh at. The Philistines, if you look at verse 23, have all assembled together. They're in Gaza for the party to end all parties. There's 3,000 of them on the roof, praising their God and rejoicing. For them, it really had been Samson versus the Philistines. And finally, they got their man. However, they're actually quite keen to show who they think has brought about their victory. Look at verse 23, this is what it says. Now the rulers of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon their god and to celebrate, saying, "Our God has delivered Samson our enemy into our hands." When the people saw him, they praised their god, saying, "Our God." A number of times they keep saying God. "Our God has delivered our enemy into our hands, the one who laid waste our land and multiplied our slain." They're pretty keen on saying, this was for Dagon. Or this was Dagon who's done all this. And we're told there was a sacrifice too. Now we're not told exactly what was sacrificed, but we do know in Canaanite lands, such as the Philistines, they sacrifice all kinds of things. Maybe humans, maybe children, we don't know. Then they call for Samson. Who knows what the performance was or the entertainment that they asked him to do? It was probably linked with some kind of humiliation. Perhaps he was stumbling around, obviously blind, looking foolish like a caged animal, and they were all laughing at him, scorning him, definitely mocking him. It was an ugly scene. So you have the sacrifices on one side, Samson's humiliation on the other. And in Samson's humiliation comes the humiliation of God. His honour is at stake. And you can imagine too the Philistines hurling insults, not just at Samson, but also at his God. Insulting the Lord while laughing at Samson. These can't be separated. It must have been noisy. As we saw in 25 high spirits, pretty sure there's quite a lot of drinking going on. This is more than just an ugly nightclub scene in town. This is something more sinister. And God isn't going to allow it. None of the Philistines will be going home praising Dagon. None of the Philistines will be going home at all. And as Samson is placed between the two pillars in verse 25, God's end plan comes into play. He's going to put an end to this party of evil using Samson one last time. God won't stand for this humiliation. God will not be mocked. As the party began, thousands were praising Dagon. But by the end of the party, no one was left singing Dagon's praises. All false praise will one day be put to an end. That has to be reassuring for us if we're on God's side. All false praise will one day be put to an end. Banished, vanquished, destroyed. It's also a warning, instruction for us. Be careful who your voice and your soul praises, whom you get excited about. Be careful who you let your children, if your parents, praise and sing to and fill their hearts with. Ensure that your heart praises God alone. And to the final act. It's the most famous image of Samson. It's the one perhaps most people remember. A man with his hair regrown, delivering his last performance. We all know the end of the story. This time, Samson knows where his strength comes from. His strength and the Lord left him. And he longs for it back one last time. And so, Samson prays. Verse 28. Samson prayed to the Lord, Sovereign Lord, remember me. Please, God, strengthen me just once more and let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes. He cries out to God in the depths of his greatest humiliation. And God hears his prayer. God remembers him. God remembers his servant Samson despite Samson's failures. Samson was humbled, as the Philistines said they would do. And yet in the depths of his humiliation, he cries out to the Lord, and the Lord answers. Can't help but notice here some parallels to Jesus' life. As Samson dies with his arms outstretched, crying out to God. I thought it was ironic, actually, that at that point in Jesus' life, with his arms outstretched, he calls about God forsaking him. And yet with Samson, it's the moment God remembers him. And there's other parallels too between Samson and Jesus. Both of their mums had angels who promised their birth. They're both to be saviours of their people, although with Samson, we've got the word beginning to save. Whereas with Jesus, obviously, it's a complete, a perfect salvation. It's not just for the Israelite people, it's for all people of all time. And also you've got the other parallel of they were both mocked and scorned and laughed at before they die with arms outstretched. So when we think of Samson, maybe we need to change how we view him. Maybe we need to think, as I said earlier, about the mirror to the Israelites and then to us. And also when we think of his death, it has to be a shadow to Jesus, the perfect death. So while the Philistines, and we're told their lords, their leaders, are destroyed under the temple in Gaza, at the cross in Golgotha, Satan and his powers are destroyed, and we're told they were exposed to open shame. In Gaza, not only is Dagon exposed as a fraud, but importantly, Samson does something really important for Israel then. And Tim Keller puts it like this, he says, He talks about the risk of Israel merging with the Philistines, and he says, this moment stopped that happening. Samson brings permanent alienation between the cultures. So Israel will become distinct, no longer under the power of the Philistines. So it's an important moment of Samson beginning to deliver his people, helping them to be holy as God is holy, not the same as the other nations, which is what would have happened if they intermarried. So remembering Samson, he's a mirror image. We should be encouraged to look inwards and check our own hearts rather than just look at him as a bad example. And also Hebrews 11 tells us how to view Samson. He's a man of faith, imperfect but used mightily by God. As the angel said, he should begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. So we'll honour the angel's words and the writer to the Hebrews as we consider Samson. And Hebrews also mentions the men of faith made strong out of weakness, which sums up Samson's final act quite nicely. And so, Judges 16 ends with the words, so the dead whom he killed were more than those whom he killed during his life. And so, in what seemed his apparent moment of weakness, it was in fact his most triumphant moment, the moment which God used him the most. And let's, as we finish, consider Jesus, at whose feet everyone will one day bow and give account to. For at the cross, it was Jesus' apparent weakness in which he triumphed most gloriously, and Satan, who looked strong, was crushed.